All right, so we're with Lorenzo Tione, producer of Allegiance, the Broadway, well, excuse me, the old Globe Smash, soon to be Broadway Smash, I'm sure. But Lorenzo, you've got an interesting history. For one thing, you're young, so I think you're a prodigy of theater. But give us a little bit about your background, where you're born, your education, born and raised, etc. Because you kind of have a global.
Yeah, well, I was born in Italy, where I grew up in Italy. And I didn't move to the United States until I was 21, and primarily to go to school. I moved to Texas, which was a big change from Milan, where I grew up, to Austin, Texas, and went to school in Austin, and worked in technology for a number of years. I actually, you know, really do think about myself more as an entrepreneur than anything else, and have been building companies and products. And
so you went to University of Texas in Austin?
Went to University of Texas in Austin for computer science. And then, you know, moved to Palo Alto, California, worked in Silicon Valley as a researcher, started an internet startup, technology company that was building a new search technology, which was later then acquired by Microsoft and became part of the relaunch technology as Bing, Bing.com, which did not exist prior to you know, the acquisition of a number of other companies, including the one I had started called PowerSet.
Wow. So
that was sort of the first foray into entrepreneurship, and I truly, really, you know, what I probably discovered about myself was I loved that part of creating, taking an idea that you think is going to be really impactful and making it happen. You know, creating the circumstances around it that can make it bloom. And you know, from the team to the funding to building a story behind it and creating a support and an early audience, and then, you know, building out that audience. And the history of how Allegiance came about, you know, sort of built upon those foundations in terms of the things that attracted me to the project of Allegiance, besides the incredible, you know, sort of value of the story, was really the idea of taking something that no one had ever done and making it, you know, sort of bringing it to existence.
So obviously you had skills in technology, and then the business skills, did you take classes in that too, or you just picked it up as you?
I think I had the incredible fortune of having great mentors and great people I worked with, and that I had the ability to observe and learn from. Mm-hmm. During my first company, I was primarily the tech, you know, founder, but I had great people I was working with and learned from them a tremendous amount.
It's an important point, mentorship. Everyone says, oh, he was a self-made man or self-made woman. Mm-hmm. I say malarkey. You know, Joe Biden says that too. But anyway, but you know, we need good influences in our life and people, you know, willing to help. Or you attach your talents with others.
True. It's something that I recognize the value of in my own experience, and that I've tried to sort of give back in. I do a lot of work with other entrepreneurs, and I run a not-for-profit I started called Startout, which helps LGBT entrepreneurs build and grow businesses. Mm. And mentorship and networking is a huge part of it, and education is really paramount to one's, you know, it's not ideas. Ideas are, everybody says ideas are dime a dozen, and it's true. Great ideas are plentiful, but it's truly execution and knowing how to take an idea and bring it to existence that makes a difference.
And getting the team behind that. Mm-hmm. Well, Robert Evans, the famous Hollywood producer, I don't know if he was a director, but he made, you know, many legendary films, Chinatown, Godfather, he was involved in all those. He said, success is where preparation meets opportunity. I thought that was a very insightful quote of
There's another famous quote that says success is, I think, 1% innovation and 99% perspiration.
Yeah. All true. So the love of theater, had you been a big theater lover all along for your entire life?
You know, I've always appreciated and loved theater. I think one passion that I've always had, and I think it's true of every entrepreneur, is that in order to build anything that has an impact and that makes people feel and move, you have to be able to tell a story. Mm-hmm. And great entrepreneurs and, you know, great salesmen are great storytellers. Mm-hmm. And the passion for theater was always something that was there, but never something I was, that was a motivation for me to be like, I have to work in theater. It was mm-hmm. never, much more than a passing thought. But mm-hmm. My co-creator and co-book writer and is the composer and lyricist for the show, Jay Kuo, and I had been good friends for a number of years. And the project of Allegiance came upon us when we both were completely by circumstance at a point in our lives where we were looking for new projects and new adventures and decided that this was a very worthy thing to try and do. Mm-hmm. We thought we'd recognize the potential. We recognized the uniqueness of it. Mm-hmm. We recognized that the country as a whole was at a time where it's right. open to the story to
we
be
might
told.
Have, maybe in the 80s or a different era, this could not be done. You
Absolutely.
Know? So, well, anyway, it's a great story how the whole idea came about. So maybe you can tell us that because everyone needs to hear that.
As I said, it's such a... You know, as a storyteller now and as a co-writer for the show, I know that everything in the story I'm about to tell you goes against every good rule of storytelling because it's so improbable and, uh-huh. And circumstantial that nobody would believe it actually exists. It actually happened that way. But
there actually could be a play about this whole
story. I know.
Story.
Jay and I were just taking a quick break and a short vacation, and we're in New York City, mm-hmm. And sat in a theater off Broadway, seeing Forbidden Broadway that night. And
love that show,
and it's just back on the boards now, so we're all very excited. But we are sitting down, and it's just about curtain to go up, and we hear two people behind us. We're talking about a show that we had seen the night before, and I'm actually paying no attention. I'm reading my playbill, but Jay has to turn around and tell them how great the show was. And all of a sudden,
what was the one the night before?
Title of show? I don't know if you know the show. It was a Broadway show that lasted a relatively short amount of time, but mm-hmm. Especially for people who are theater lovers and mm-hmm. passionate, it's such a fun show. Mm-hmm. I noticed that Jay is talking and all of a sudden stops mid-sentence, which is completely uncharacteristic of Jay to stop talking. So I'm turning around to see what's going on. And it's George Takei and his husband, Brad mm-hmm. Altman, Brad mm-hmm. Takei, who were there to see a show. And, we strike up conversations like, how often do you meet mm-hmm. George Takei on the mm-hmm. street? So,
and, of course, you're locked in because he's...
I know, we're sitting next to
him. It's not like you're passing on the...
But, that night, nothing happened other than exchanging niceties and, you're here to see theater, we're here to see theaters, we come here often and all that. And but the next night, Jay and I are seeing a different show on Broadway that night. We're seeing In the Heights. And we sit down, and George and Brad are sitting next to us, completely by chance. At which point, I think they asked us if we were stalking them, which was... But we weren't, and we sit down and, say hello and watch the show. And it's about, three quarters through the first act, and there's a song in the show where the father is singing about his daughter and about his inability to help her. He's an immigrant, and he's trying his best to give her a good life, but he's unable to do so. And he sings this beautiful song called Useless, Inutile. And and George, we look over, and George is weeping, like really just completely moved.
Whoa.
So, at intermission, the lights come up, and he's still like that. And he's like, wow, George, that really moved you. What was it? It really spoke to you. And George goes into telling us how it reminded him of his own father and his family when, as a child of four, armed guards came and took his family away from their home and brought them to an internment camp where they lived for 4 years.
Where was he at the time and where they
moved? He lived in Los Angeles mm-hmm. at the time. And to be precise, what happened to Japanese Americans in the area where he lived, they were suddenly, shortly after Pearl Harbor, taken following the signing of Executive Order 9066, which President Roosevelt signed, and which declared this entire area of the United States as a zone where Japanese Americans could not live freely. So they were all rounded up, and his family, along with other people in that area, were taken to a racetrack, you know, the Santa Anita racetrack around Los Angeles, where they were left for months living in the worst possible conditions. I mean, living in horse stalls with no sanitation, and, you know, and they didn't even know what would happen of them. You know, they didn't know if they were would be moved somewhere. They weren't really sure if they should be in fear for their own life and safety. I mean, it was a very, 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 you know, horrible situation to be in. And then a few months later, after all the camps actually had been built, all of these families were moved into a number of different camps across the southern United States, some of which were in California. But the ones, the one where he and his family was sent was in Arkansas. It was called Roar Camp. And he lived in two different camps. He lived in Roar Camps, Roar Camp in Arkansas. And then one egregious thing that happened was that at some point the United States government required of all Japanese Americans who were interned to sign what's called a questionnaire, a loyalty questionnaire. And many questions were asked of the internees, but some of them were, you know, in a way aimed at determining who were the disloyal or the troublemakers. And you know, we could go at length and talk about this, but these were questions that were insulting in a way of American citizens whose liberty and freedom had been taken away from them. And in a sense, also misleading questions. Yeah. And some people who answered in certain ways to these questions were marked as troublemakers and taken to an even harsher camp in the northern plains of California called Tule Lake. And his family, because of his father and mother's answers, were amongst the people that were taken to this camp. So he lived in two different camps, Roar Camp, Arkansas, and Tule Lake.
So he's a boy of 4 years old. What year? 42, I guess they were.
It was 1942. February 19th, 1942 was when, 1942 was when the Executive Order 9066 was signed. So I think I think they were moved in, you know, late summer from the Santa Anita racetrack. They were moved into Roar, and then about a year later, they were moved into Tule Lake.
And then when were they allowed?
1945.
Yeah. So, wow. Well, you know, look, we've got Guantanamo Bay now. You know, these things happen.
You know, truly, when we heard about the story from George, you know, that evening, we heard about him telling us that, we were inspired to start, you know, reading so much and researching so much. And a few weeks later, we wrote back to George, you know, in a very kind of sort of, you know, thinking the worst thing that can happen is he'll say no. But we told him, look, you know, for the
So you and Jay had this concept, maybe we should.
Yeah. So we were on this trip, and we spent no other time than talking about this and researching it. And 3 weeks later, we had a title song and a treatment for what at that time was a very different story and a different show than it's been over the course of the last 4.5 years that we've developed this. But we wrote back to George and said, we're doing this and we think you should do this with us. And he wrote back saying, telling the story of the internment of Japanese Americans to the widest possible audience has been my lifelong mission.
Wow.
And
wow.
I could easily see this as being my legacy project. And he does call this his legacy project.
I'm getting goosebumps.
We did too at that time. He said he wanted to see this through with us. And he's been part of the project ever since. And shortly after that, you know, the incomparable Lea Salonga was also attached to the project. And she's been part of it since the very beginning.
So Lea is amazing in this
yes,
show.
Yes, she is.
Did you know of her? But I mean, who put the George help find her?
No. You know, it's interesting. You kind of think about these things with your dream cap on, and you say, well, we need an Asian leading lady. Who do we ask, right? And you know, and when you think about musical theater and musical theater voices and Asian actresses, I mean, there's just no other name that comes to mind before Lea Salonga. So, you know, Miss Saigon, Tony Award winner when she was 17, and
so you got Joe DiMaggio and Babe Ruth right off the start there. I mean,
right.
you guys had the Yankees. I mean,
you know, the reason why the way that Lea got attached to the project is also a very fortuitous circumstance, because you know, we certainly had in mind, well, we got to ask Lea, And we, you know, we kind of flanked her. We mm-hmm. sent her the material through multiple people who mm-hmm. could reach out to her and her agent and so on. But there were two things that happened that played to our advantage that we had absolutely no idea. The first one was that we had decided to do the first presentation in L.A., mm-hmm. of all places, at the Japanese American National Museum, which has been, you know, a sort of a great institution that has continued to further along the message of mm-hmm. the internment. And Leia has family in Los Angeles, and we didn't know, so it was not too much of a stretch for her to be out there, and we were willing to bring her out and mm-hmm. work with her for a couple of days. But the second most important thing was, she's a big Star Trek fan. And the idea of working with Sulu for a weekend was actually very fun and and attractive to her, to the point where we had our very first rehearsals to the show in George Takei's living room. Here, Leia Salonga arrives, and within minutes, she's tweeting to her million-plus followers, I'm in Sulu's living room.
So she was beamed up, and... Well, this is great, you know. So all the stars have aligned for you, and I really appreciate you taking time to be on our show.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, we're just going to move along, and we'll get into it with Wendy, for the rest of the program. So thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Good luck with everything.
Thank you.
I'm sure we'll be hearing more things.
Yeah, we're looking to bring the show to Broadway by the fall. So mm-hmm. you know, hopefully everything will align in that direction, and it's an interesting and long road ahead, and it's been a long road so far, but we're very excited about where we've been.
You're all on the Starship Enterprise, so thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Okay.